Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, the Texas abortion law and what it says about the Supreme Court's shadow docket. The new law in Texas blocks almost all pregnant women from accessing an abortion. It also allows private citizens to sue anyone allegedly involved in an abortion more than 4 weeks after conception. Last week, the Supreme Court declined to intervene and let the ban go into effect. The response by abortion advocates was swift and strong, not only opposing the court's opinion, but how it was decided. Stephen Vladeck, professor of law at the University of Texas Law School, joins me to talk about details of the Texas law and new questions being raised about transparency at the nation's highest court. First of all, Professor Vladeck, can you talk about the immediate effect on women who live in the state of Texas and want an abortion? What's going to happen to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that as of last Wednesday, it got much, much harder for women in Texas to obtain an abortion, even those few abortions that are still legal, even under SB 8. So, you know, providers across the state have generally stopped providing services, certainly to anyone seeking an abortion after the sixth week of pregnancy, but some have even stopped providing all services because, you know, it's no longer viable for them if all they're able to do is provide abortions to only those very small subset of pregnant women who both find out before the sixth week that they're pregnant and decide to have an abortion that period. So, Diane, I think it's fair to say that the effects have been catastrophic from the perspective of the availability of abortions in the second largest state.
But what about Attorney General Merrick Garland's statement on last Monday, that the Justice Department would protect women who are seeking an abortion? What kind of protection can the Department of Justice offer?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I'm not sure we know the answer. The real complication here, and I think the piece of SB 8 that is both the hardest for folks to grasp and doing the most work in why we're in this quandary, is that SB 8 takes Texas, the state, entirely out of the loop when it comes to enforcement. Usually the way we enforce our constitutional rights is by asking a court to block a state from keeping a law on the books that's unconstitutional, from enforcing a law that's unconstitutional. Without the state in the middle of the story, it's not clear why the Justice Department is any better situated than the providers here in Texas to bring these lawsuits. Indeed, the best that these lawsuits can accomplish without some weird new kind of relief is to stop individual people from bringing lawsuits under SB 8, is to stop individual plaintiffs from suing the providers. Diane, from the provider's perspective, that doesn't help. And so if the Justice Department's going to prosecute, let's say, an anti-abortion group that sues Planned Parenthood for trying to infringe upon the constitutional rights of Texas women, even if that suit succeeds, all it does is it blocks that group from suing under SB 8. It does not actually block SB 8 in a way that would allow the providers to reopen their doors.
So who is supposed to enforce this law?
Well, it's supposed to be enforced by random people. This is why so many folks call it vigilantes or bounty hunters. But the problem, Diane, is that that's really a distraction. Like, it's understandable why folks are fixated on that especially onerous part of the law. The key is not that it authorizes private enforcement. The key is that it precludes state enforcement, because it's the absence of the state that is why these lawsuits have not yet been able to succeed. It's the absence of Texas as a party that prevents Planned Parenthood or Whole Woman's Health or anyone else from obtaining a judicial order, an injunction, blocking the law on a statewide basis. And so it's designed this way on purpose. It is a, you know, procedural trap that the vigilante piece is just the window dressing. What's really going on here is by absenting the state from enforcement, they are frustrating normal judicial review that would obviously and quite quickly, in any other context, strike down the substantive abortion ban as being flatly inconsistent with Roe and Casey.
So are we going to see other states using this same approach?
I think we very well might. I mean, we've already seen, I believe it was the president of the Florida State Senate who announced that they were going to introduce legislation modeled on Texas's. You know, this is where I think the Chief Justice's dissent from Wednesday's abortion decision is perhaps the most, I think, impactful, because his point, which I think is something we should be able to agree upon without regard to our ideology, his point is that this is no way to run a railroad. That, like, whether you like the right at issue or not, we should not be in a world in which each state legislature can frustrate the enforcement of constitutional rights through these kinds of procedural shenanigans. And that's exactly where we are. So if Texas can do this to abortion, if Florida can do this to abortion, why can't California do it to guns? Why can't Vermont do it to environmental regulation? And in that universe, all of a sudden, our constitutional rights aren't worth much more than what our state legislature has chosen to let them be worth.
That's pretty scary.
It's pretty scary. And in that regard, I think perhaps the beyond the universe of abortion, perhaps the most important thing that the court did Wednesday night was not bless that. In other words, even if you read the very long paragraph that the majority wrote to explain why it was not blocking the Texas abortion law, you'll be hard-pressed to find a single word endorsing what Texas did. And so I think the justices understand, Diane, just how scary a world that would be. And I think there, as much as I think there's a majority of justices who don't care that much about protecting Roe and Casey, I think that majority and then some care quite a lot about protecting the role of the courts in deciding what our constitutional rights are and are not. And so I think if and when the time comes, you know, that's going to be its own massive fight that I think the courts will settle on. Well, I hope at least the courts will settle on the side of the courts.
All right, but let's go back to abortion. If, in fact, in Texas, it now becomes virtually impossible to get an abortion because some person might cite an abortion clinic or a doctor or a person seeking an abortion, and that person or site might be fined $10,000. I mean, where does this leave abortion as we go forward? Is this a way, a route by which to do away with Roe v. Wade?
So I think the short answer is it is a route by which states can at least temporarily make Roe a dead letter. And that is a especially problematic thing because women seeking to vindicate their right under Roe do not exactly have a lot of time. And so even temporary efforts like this will be enormously successful in preventing a very, very significant group of women from obtaining a lawful abortion. I think the tricky part, and I don't mean to be formalistic, but I don't think it's quite right to say it's therefore doing away with Roe in the sense that the right kind of lawsuit should be able to block this, right? That indeed, I think it's a matter of time before the Texas state courts start saying that SB 8 is unconstitutional. The problem is that those rulings are not going to open the clinic's doors overnight because, again, of this procedural, you know, Rube Goldberg device that the state legislature has built, has concocted. And so I think there really is a distinction here between Roe being, for the moment, functionally dead in Texas, which is an enormous problem, and Roe as a precedent, where I still think that the Supreme Court has not yet relegated it to the historical dustbin. The question, Diane, is how do we square those two things? And that's why I, for one, was especially disappointed that the Supreme Court on Wednesday night did not intervene, because I think, you know, the court can say as a matter of pure legal analysis that we are not getting rid of Roe, even though we're allowing SB 8 to go into effect. On the ground in Texas today, that's a distinction without a difference.
So there is a piece of this that, I mean, there's a lot I don't understand about this, but one piece in particular, in her dissent, Justice Elena Kagan specifically highlighted the court's erratic shadow docket decision making. Explain what this shadow docket is.
Yeah, so this is actually something that I've been writing about for a while, and it's kind of weird that now it's a thing. The shadow docket is a term that was invented in 2015 by a Chicago law professor named Will Bode, but it actually has been around forever. And it's not as nefarious as it sounds. I mean, it's really a term, Diane, that lawyers and law professors use to describe that part of the Supreme Court's work that is less visible to the public. Most of which is fairly anodyne case management, where the court is issuing orders about when cases are going to be heard or which cases are going to be heard or who's going to participate in the case. Things that, Diane, no one's going to lose any sleep over. There's a very small slice of this orders docket that involves what are called requests for emergency relief. And this is when a party has lost in a lower court. The appeal's going to take some time. And the question is, while that appeal is going, what's the law on the ground going to be? What is the status quo going to be? And it's there that we've seen in the last 5-6 years an enormous uptick, not just in the number of cases where the Supreme Court is issuing emergency relief, is changing the status quo pending appeal, but also, Diane, in what kinds of cases we're seeing it. So as opposed to, say, the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, where most of those emergency applications dealt with death row inmates on the eve of their execution, those were obviously important, but they weren't making statewide or national law. Now we're seeing emergency applications about the CDC eviction moratorium or the Texas abortion law or President Trump's immigration policies. And whatever the court is doing in this context is therefore affecting so many more people than was true historically.
So why has the number of cases that have been considered this way via this so-called shadow docket, how come that's gone up so much in the past few years?
Yeah, no, Diane, it's the right question. And I think reasonable people are going to disagree a bit about some of the causes, but here are a couple. First, we have the Trump administration. And the Trump administration radically increased the number of times the Supreme Court was asked to provide this kind of relief. So here, just as a data point, across the George W. Bush and Obama administration, so 16 years, two very different presidencies, the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court for emergency relief 8 times, so once every other year on average. In 4 years, the Trump administration asked for such relief 41 times. So now you're going to hear different things about whether they were reacting to sort of unfair resistance from lower court judges or whether it was actually their problematic policies, right, that were at issue. I think we know where people are going to fall on that. Just descriptively, though, the volume of cases where the Supreme Court was asked to intervene rose dramatically. And I think once the court started intervening more, it became easier for the court to intervene more, right? That this sort of the snowball started running down the hill. So this actually started as very much a Trump administration phenomenon, but it has not remained one. We saw a number of very high profile shadow docket rulings last fall around the election. We've seen a bunch of very high profile shadow docket rulings this year and late last year with regard to state COVID policies.
Give me an example of some that were considered during the election.
Sure. So, I mean, in the month leading up to the election, there was a fight over South Carolina and the signature requirement on absentee ballots, where the court actually blocked lower court rulings that had suspended with the signature requirement. There was Pennsylvania, where there was a fight over whether the Pennsylvania Supreme Court could allow for the counting of late arriving mail-in or absentee ballots, where the court actually split 4-4, with Justice Ginsburg's seat, of course, having been vacant since her death on September 18th. After the election, there was an effort by Congressman Mike Kelly to get the Supreme Court to freeze a lower court ruling that had refused to block Pennsylvania from certifying its electoral votes, and the Supreme Court rejected Kelly's application. So these were all, you know, high-profile, Diane, shadow docket rulings in the sense that they were orders, not opinions, in the sense that, you know, the Supreme Court dealt with most of these through one sentence of unsigned analysis. And, you know, that's sort of, in some respects, inevitable in election cases, but sort of to the point that this has become more common as it's become more common. I think it felt less weird to the court to be getting all of these election cases in this context, given how much time they've spent over the last 4 years taking other cases in this context.
And they have the justices who've remained on the court changed their views on any of these situations?
So, I mean, I don't think the justices have changed their views, Diane. I think the court has changed. And so if you actually look at the patterns, you know, there's no question in the data that this practice becomes even more prevalent in the summer of 2018. Well, what happens in the summer of 18? Justice Kavanaugh is confirmed to replace Justice Kennedy. I don't think it should shock us that, you know, now that the conservatives had a solid fifth vote as opposed to a periodic fifth vote, one of the things that happens is they become more willing to grant emergency relief, something that takes five votes. But then, Diane, we really see a shift when Justice Barrett is confirmed last November. So one especially aggressive type of relief that the court issues on the shadow docket is an emergency injunction pending appeal. What's different about this is here's a case where the lower courts have not blocked, let's say, a state COVID restriction. And the parties are, the challengers want to challenge that on appeal, but they want the Supreme Court to block it while the appeal is pending. This is the highest bar. This is the relief that takes the greatest showing in the Supreme Court. So much so that in John Roberts' first 15 years as Chief Justice, the court issued such relief four times. Since Justice Barrett came on the court in November, it's issued seven injunctions, blocking COVID restrictions in New York and California, blocking New York's eviction moratorium. And so, you know, I think it's not that the justices are changing, it's that the justices have changed. And that's reflected in just how much more common these rulings are becoming. Now, some will say that doesn't mean they're not justified. That's fair. My point is just that this is a phenomenon that has really accelerated as the court has changed in ways that I think we're only now really beginning to appreciate as a polity.
Well, then that gets to the question of how this, quote, shadow docket is managed. Are there guidelines as to when potential harm has to take precedent over procedure?
There absolutely are. I mean, so not to get sort of too into the legal weeds for a second, but different types of relief come with different standards. So we were just talking about injunctions. So to get an injunction, the party is supposed to show that the government action that they're challenging is interfering with rights that are indisputably clear, where letting the litigation continue without blocking the state law will actually cause irreparable harm to the party. And the court has said that it's still following that standard, but it's very hard to believe it. And so a good example here, there's an April ruling in a case called Tandon versus Newsom, which was about California's restrictions on in-home gatherings. California said you can't have members of more than three households in your home for any reason, right, as a COVID suppression measure. And a pastor and a couple of other, a Bible study group leader challenged the restrictions on the ground that this interfered with their right to have religious practice in their home because it was stopping them from having Bible study and other religious gatherings in private homes. The Supreme Court agreed and by a 5-4 vote issued an injunction. But here's the key, Diane, to get there, the court had to read the free exercise clause of the Constitution to require something from the government it had never read it to require before. In other words, right, the court made new law in a context in which it's only supposed to be able to issue relief if the underlying right is, quote, indisputably clear. Well, how can a new principle have been indisputably clear? This, you know, this is what people like me are worried about, right, is that it's not just that there are more of these cases. It's that the court in these cases is doing things it's not supposed to be doing and is not exactly going out of its way to elaborate as to why.
So we who do not sit on the court then are going to have to worry about what's happening to our constitutional rights.
That's right. And I think, you know, if folks take nothing else away, Diane, from our conversation, you know, I hope that folks appreciate that what the Supreme Court does is so much more than the sum total of the big heralded rulings that we talk about every spring and summer, right? That, yes, the court hands down these big, long, lengthy decisions on gay marriage or DACA or the Second Amendment. But that's really only a small slice of the pie. And, you know, historically, that has been the much more important and much more interesting part of the pie, which is why we've all gravitated toward it. It's also the more accessible part of the pie. We can read those opinions, even if we're not lawyers, and understand at least much of what they're saying. And I think, you know, my concern is whatever the merits of how the shadow docket has changed what the court does, the shadow docket is less accessible. It's less accessible to the public. We don't understand what it is. We don't understand why it's different from the merits docket. We don't understand the different constraints that's supposed to bind the court in that context. And so as that becomes more and more prevalent, as bigger and bigger questions are being resolved on the shadow docket, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to, you know, expect more discussion of that part of the court's work.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Stephen Vladeck. Here's the rest of my conversation with Professor Stephen Vladeck of the University of Texas School of Law. He's currently working on a forthcoming book about the shadow docket. Okay, I want to go back to A in the alphabet. How does the Supreme Court normally decide to take a case as opposed to using this so-called shadow docket? Explain the difference.
Sure. So, I mean, the typical case the Supreme Court hears, at the end of the day, the Supreme Court is usually last, Diane, in the whole conversation. Justice Jackson had a very famous line that we're not final because we're infallible. We're infallible only because we're final, right? That his point was that, like, we go last. And what that means is that cases come to the Supreme Court only after years of litigation in state court or federal court, maybe multiple rounds in state court and federal court, and that by the time a case gets to the Supreme Court, the issues have been very thoroughly ventilated, where it's been extensively briefed, where the multiple courts have weighed in on it, where, you know, the issues that maybe were not as important to the case have fallen out of it, right? Where the Supreme Court's getting to just the big piece that really, really matters. And so in most cases, Diane, that's usually several years after the lawsuit's filed before it gets to the Supreme Court. And even once it gets to the Supreme Court, that's a laborious process where the first thing you have to do is ask the Supreme Court to agree to hear a case because most of the Supreme Court's jurisdiction is discretionary. So you have a whole round of briefing at what the lawyers call the cert or certiorari stage just to try to persuade the court to take your case. And if you're one of the few who convinces them to do it, then there's a whole nother round of briefing at what we call the merits stage, where you actually explain why you should win. That briefing usually comes with lots of other briefs from so-called friends of the court. It's followed by an oral argument where the parties get to fully debate the views with the justices. And it culminates in a lengthy signed opinion of the court that in, you know, sometimes as many as 300 pages, sometimes closer to 15, those are better, right, actually tells us why the court is ruling the way it is. That's the norm for, you know, having the Supreme Court decide a case. The tricky part is what to do while it takes those years, Diane, for the case to get all the way through the courts. What's the status quo going to be? Should the status quo be that the bad government policy we're challenging is allowed to stay in effect? Should it be that the bad government policy is frozen while this all goes through the courts? And it's that very, very early question about what the status quo should be while the normal litigation process works, that's where we're seeing so much more pressure on the shadow docket.
Professor Vladek, now that the shadow docket has been used successfully on this very prominent abortion Texas case, do you see it being used again and again?
Diane, for better or for worse, I think we've seen the shadow docket become a much more important part of the Supreme Court's work across any number of areas. I do think that the shadow docket, at least as we understand it today, isn't going anywhere, especially because there are now five justices who clearly aren't troubled by it. I don't think that was true as recently as a year ago. I mean, I think, you know, Chief Justice Roberts has actually dissented four different times this term, with the three Democratic appointees, entirely, I think, because he thinks these are not appropriate things to be doing on the shadow docket. The problem is that whereas as recently as a year ago, that would have been dispositive, now it's not. And so I think we're in for more and more use of the shadow docket and potentially abuse of it, until and unless either one of the five justices in the majority in Wednesday's ruling pushes back, or Congress steps in. And in this respect, I think it's not for nothing that in her dissent from Wednesday's order, Justice Kagan, who really does, I think, try as much as any of the three Democratic appointees to stay in conversation with the conservatives, to try to basically broker compromises where they're available. Well, Justice Kagan, for the first time on Wednesday, came after them for the shadow docket specifically. And indeed, it was the first opinion in which she has expressly and publicly criticized the use of the shadow docket and the inconsistency of the shadow docket. Justice Sotomayor had done it before, but this is the first time we'd heard it from Justice Kagan. I would not overlook the significance of that moment. I wrote a piece in the Washington Post about exactly what her complaint was and why it was well taken. And I think the question is, are we going to see any softening of this going forward? I do think the court has already reacted to some of this criticism. So the last couple of big orders, Diane, that we've gotten on the shadow docket have had at least a little more analysis. The eviction moratorium order from 2 weeks ago, they actually wrote an 8-page opinion explaining what they were doing. So I think the justices are hearing some of the criticism, but not all of it. And I think the question is going to be whether there's anything at this point that pushes the five justices to the right of Chief Justice Roberts to, in any extent, moderate how often they're using the shadow docket and for what purposes.
Wow. So what's next then for the abortion law in Texas? It stays for now?
It stays for now. It's on the books as you and I are speaking. And this is so, even though, I mean, I think a lot of folks keep seeing these headlines about local judges in Texas blocking SB 8. That's not really true. What's happening is there are a bunch of individual lawsuits where providers and other pro-abortion groups are obtaining temporary restraining orders against particular people from bringing lawsuits to enforce SB 8, not against SB 8 itself. And that's going to be where we are, Diane, until and unless there's some mechanism by which SB 8 can be blocked on a statewide basis. The lawsuit that I think has the best chance of doing that procedurally is the one the Supreme Court refused to intervene in last week. Because what the plaintiffs are doing in that case is they're trying to have the courts certify a defendant class of all of the state court judges in Texas and all of the state court clerks in Texas to block them from taking SB 8 cases because they can't block the state. Because again, the state's not a party. And so that's the kind of relief that I fear we're going to need before this law can actually be blocked to such an extent that the providers will be allowed to reopen. And folks may say that's really crazy. And I say, yes, and that's the point, right? That the legislature designed this law on purpose to make it virtually immune from what we call a pre-enforcement challenge, which is how most abortion restrictions are blocked. And to make it very hard to challenge even while it's on the books. Because even, Diane, even if a provider persuades a state court that the law is unconstitutional because it violates Roe and Casey, which it does, that judgment only binds the plaintiff to that case. It doesn't bind the state. And that's the procedural trap that this is designed to exploit. So I think that's why so much attention was on that federal case. That's why it was such a big deal that the Supreme Court did not use that case to intervene. Even Chief Justice Roberts, who is no fan of Roe and Casey, I think what was at pains to say, we should not indulge this cynical ploy by the state legislature. We should block the law while these questions are worked out. But I think this is where we're going to be, at least until and unless there's some broader effort to block the law on a statewide basis.
You've got the Supreme Court scheduled to hear a Mississippi law that eliminates the constitutional right to an abortion after 15 weeks. When is that case supposed to be heard, and how might that ruling affect what's happening in Texas?
Yeah, so the Mississippi case is a case called Dobbs, which is the normal way a case gets to the Supreme Court, right? Which is a sort of a fully briefed merits case. The court has not scheduled it for argument yet, but it is going to hear it probably, Diane, in December, I think is the current thinking. The Mississippi law bans just about all abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. That is flatly inconsistent with Roe and Casey. Under Casey, the Constitution protects a right to a pre-viability abortion. States are not allowed to impose undue burdens. Well, a categorical ban is about as close to a clear undue burden as one can come up with. The parties in Dobbs have asked the Supreme Court to overrule Roe. I think there is a view out there that there's a way the court could do both. That is to say, it could weaken Roe without overruling it while upholding the Mississippi law by moving the line from viability to 15 weeks. That would be, I think, impossible to reconcile logically with Roe or Casey, but that has not exactly always stopped the Supreme Court before. Here's the thing, though. What I think drives the point home is there's a world in which at least some of Casey survives, even if the Mississippi law is upheld, right? There's a world in which women would still have broad access to abortions up to the 15th week of pregnancy, and a constitutional right to broad access, even if the Mississippi law survives. There's no universe in which the Texas law and Roe coexist, right? That however much a 15-week ban can't be reconciled with Roe and Casey, a 6-week ban is just completely diametrically opposed to them. And so that's why I think the SB8 case is sort of lurking, right, as a big deal substantively and procedurally, because if the court upholds the Mississippi ban without ditching Roe, then the question is going to be how much, well, if the state can do 15 weeks, can it do 10? And if it can do 10, can it do 6? And at that point, Roe's dead.
So do you expect other states to quickly come up with other kinds of, quote, citizen enforcement bills on other divisive issues, like, for example, voting rights?
Yeah, I mean, voting rights are tricky because voting is, of course, such a quintessential government action. And it's hard to take the government out of the voting business. But other rights, gun rights, say, speech rights, right? I mean, imagine a universe where I can sue Facebook and the state has nothing to do with enforcement of a law that, prohibits Facebook from blocking accounts. I mean, the slippery slope here is really, really steep and leads to a pretty terrifying abyss. And so that's why, what drives me, I think, the most nuts about this law, it's no surprise, Diane, that people's dander gets up about abortion. I mean, that's always going to be true. That folks who support the substance of SB8 can't see past it to realize how horrifying a world is in which states can do this to any of our constitutional rights, I think is deeply disillusioning, because it suggests that procedure is just a means to an end as opposed to an important end unto itself.
What would it take to prohibit these kinds of laws generally? And would you be in favor of that?
I mean, I think it ought to not be a controversial proposition that whenever a state passes a law that allegedly infringes upon a constitutional right, the state is a proper defendant to a lawsuit challenging that restriction. Even if the state has absented itself from enforcement, it is still a law that emanates from the state. The state should therefore still be a proper party. And, Diane, you and I and plenty of your listeners may disagree about which right should and should not be, have what scope. So be it, right? But the courts, if we're going to have a judicial system, then that should be up to the courts. And the state should not be able to dodge unconstitutional legislation just by removing itself from the enforcement process.
This is a long battle.
Yes.
And one that is coming, no question.
I dare say one that is here.
Professor Vladek, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Professor Stephen Vladek at the University of Texas School of Law. He's also co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, co-host of National Security Law Podcast, and a CNN legal analyst. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.